Hi, class. This is Dr. Hughes in EDU 613, Cultivating Pro-Social Behavior. And we're here today talking with our district BCBA, who is joining me and is about to introduce herself. So, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me, Dr. Hughes. My name is Therese Genest. I am the District Board Certified Behavior Analyst in the East Greenwich Public Schools. So you're probably wondering what that means. As a BCBA, I'm an individual that's trained to provide and supervise the application of applied behavior analysis, which is a science devoted to the understanding and improvement of human behavior. What's important about what we do and what sets us apart from other fields is the focus on behaviors that have social significance, as well as the systematic intervention to improve and reduce the behavior, depending on what we're looking at. So specifically, to become a BCBA, you can earn a graduate degree in a related field, applied behavior analysis, education, psychology, complete relevant coursework related to applied behavior analysis, 1,500 hours of supervised independent field work. So that can be done in a variety of settings. I did mine in a private school placement with students with significant special needs, and then pass a national board certification exam. There are many areas that BCBAs work in. A lot of people know us as working with people with autism and related disabilities, but we also work with instructional designs, organizational behavior management, and there are animal applications as well, things like zoos and aquariums.
So that's such a, that's a long list, Therese, and it's such a fascinating field to really think about the scope of your work. And in thinking about that, not every district has access to a board certified behavior analyst or BCBA. And in fact, this is in your first year here in the district. We hadn't had one at all. We had a consultation model, and you actually were involved in that working through a private agency. And so now with, you stepping into the district, it's a bit different. So in thinking about that, in working in the school setting, currently you're in a district that has your position. And so, through that lens, and also the lens of what happens when a school does not have someone who's designated to that work, can you explain a little bit about the work that you do in your role in the school setting? And you can kind of speak about it probably from the consultation model that we previously had through the agency, as well as now how you're engaged.
Sure. Yeah. So within a school setting, first and foremost, it is always a consultation model, whether you're in the school or whether you're being called from an outside agency, because teams will call a BCBA in to assess a situation. So typically it's challenging behavior. Other times it's a skill acquisition issue. So there's a lot of areas of focus where we can kind of look. Things like inclusion, increasing those opportunities, making them applicable, looking at problem behavior reduction, skill acquisition, communication deficits, and then specifically staff training. So especially in that consultation model, it's really important to work with the staff who are with students day in and day out to build the capacity within the school, within the team. So that's educators, special educators, other service providers. So there's basic skills that we can train depending on the setting. So if it's, pre-K through second grade, it might look a little different from if it's grade 6 through grade 12. Making sure that whatever capacity they have, we're building that to make sure that the students are receiving the services they need. And then there may be more specific cases where the student requires a functional behavior assessment and a related behavior intervention plan. They may also need specific IEP goals written and progress monitored related to those goals. So some of those things can happen, whether it's on a consulting basis or in collaboration with the team, using different assessments, whether it's the functional behavior assessment, or we can look at criterion referenced assessments for those skill acquisition needs.
So in thinking about challenging behavior, and you've certainly seen your fair share of that, what are some of the most common challenging behaviors that you see within the school setting?
Yeah, so there's a large range of challenging behaviors. And what I try to look at is what makes it challenging. Is it interfering with the student's learning? So that can be anything from difficulty sitting for a duration of time. Students are up and down out of their chairs. It can be talking out. It can be not having hands in other people's space. It can also go to aggression, whether it's peers or adults or destroying property. So anything that's really interfering with the student's learning. Similarly, a challenging behavior can be a communication deficit. So looking at ways that we can help students communicate their needs and wants.
That's great. And so I'm sure that you've had the experience of working in a school where a teacher, a general educator or special educator, regardless of the level, because we work with preschool through grade 12, says to you or comes to you and says, I don't know what to do with this kid. This kid cannot behave. You know, have you heard these statements? Or I'm going crazy with this student. I don't know what to do about X, Y, and Z. So how do you approach that? Or how does an IEP team or a problem solving crisis team come together to start the process of trying to decipher what is going on?
Yeah, those are things that I hear pretty frequently. And it's difficult. It's a big challenge, I'm sure, for the educators and for everyone involved. But remembering that the student themselves is having a difficult time. So data collection is vital to the systematic intervention model of ABA. So we're looking at assessment, planning, implementation, and evaluation. So first and foremost, there needs to be some data collection surrounding an objective and individualized target behavior. So what that means is the student's out of control, the student's dysregulated. I really need to take that information and I need to create an operational definition that is very clear and objective about what the behavior looks like so that we can collect data on it. When is it happening? Where is it happening? How frequently is it happening? So we really need that operational definition to remove the subjectivity and get a clear picture of what the behavior looks like and how we can intervene with it. It's also really important that I'm looking at those environmental conditions. So I'm coming into this situation where there's a student having a difficult time exhibiting challenging behavior. I also need to know what's going on in their environment, their classroom, their school. And I need to make sure that the behavior I'm looking at is observable and measurable.
That is one of the key components there. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that and thinking about observable and measurable. And what does that mean? And so the operational definitions of behavior, really coming to terms with exactly what is it we're seeing and how do we measure that? And so in thinking about that, in thinking about data collection, how do you work with or how do you encourage others to collect data? How would that be set up with, say, a special educator?
Yeah, so they're always the first point of contact because they're the people with a student, typically the special educator or educator, almost all day. They're seeing them across settings, day in, day out. So I like to start with an ABC model of data collection. That's an antecedent behavior and consequence. It's really important to be able to collect information not only about what the behavior itself looks like and how it's being exhibited, but the antecedent. So whatever's happening immediately before the behavior, as well as the consequence, whatever is happening immediately following the behavior. Those things are really important because the consequence will shape if it continues in the past, in the future. And we're also looking at the antecedent to see what kind of things in the environment do we need to manipulate or can we manipulate. So even really common examples and what I try to work with special educators on is small details, large details, anything that seems like it's important needs to be in that data because it's going to tell us if a student is sensitive to if the classroom is too loud or too quiet, if there are a lot of students around or only a few students around, if work was being presented or if something was terminated. So it's really important to get that information. And it's always a great place to start with a special educator, just knowing that it's a pretty basic overview of what's happening immediately before, during, and after.
That's great. And so in thinking about that data collection tool, and you mentioned the ABC data, you know, how does that look in a classroom or when you're starting the initial collection of data?
So initially that can look a lot of different ways and it should be pretty individualized to the student, but most often it will start with a basic chart or just some note-taking that looks at that antecedent behavior and consequence. And I like to create tools for special educators or for paraprofessionals working in classrooms to be able to take that data quickly in the moment and be able to continue with what they're doing. Because it's difficult to get that buy-in from a teacher. If you're giving them more work to do, extra work, it really needs to be data that's collected with fidelity. And that's usually the way that it will look.
That's great. That's great. And so let's talk a little bit more about, you know, we're collecting this data after we have a problem behavior, we're taking notes, we're determining kind of what's happening. And, you know, where does that go from there when you start thinking about the functional behavior assessment?
Yeah, that's a question I get a lot regarding what's happening with this data, right? So that data is being used as part of a functional behavior assessment. And the premise of an FBA is that behavior is not random. It's influenced by the environment, and the consequences of a behavior influence future behavior. So as we collect that data, whether it's ABC or frequency or duration, we're looking for patterns related to those consequences in the environment. The functional behavior assessment itself is an overall process of assessing the function of behavior. It enables us to be able to hypothesize the function that specific behaviors serve and lead us to the most appropriate interventions. So saying that means we're looking at what function the behavior serves so that we're not arbitrarily assigning an intervention to it. It needs to be in alignment with the function so that we can teach some functionally equivalent alternative behaviors. So something that's easy to engage in, serves the same function, and is socially appropriate. So we're looking at functions maintaining behavior as attention, escape, tangible, and automatic. So making sure that we align the interventions to that. So that process of the FBA includes direct observation time, indirect assessments working with the teachers and caregivers who know the student well, and then there's experimental analysis looking at those consequences and environmental things we can manipulate.
So in thinking about that, in terms of attention and escape, and I think about those two primarily because I think about the kinds of things that I hear around the multidisciplinary team table, right? And or just hear about when you walk through a class and you kind of hear about a particular student who is, you know, maybe doing a lot of yelling or calling out. And so you develop the data collection and you kind of have a hypothesis moving forward that perhaps this behavior is the function of attention seeking or wanting that attention. So what kinds of things does a teacher do, or do you recommend for a teacher in a given situation like that? That's one part. And then what about escape? So students who may not be wanting to complete a task that someone else wants them to do, you know, and how do you kind of make recommendations based on those? I know those are two kind of general profiles, but
yeah,
I think they're real common to what we see in the schools.
They definitely are common. And in thinking in terms of a student who is engaging in behavior that is maintained by attention, we think of attention as something that's always positive, but it can be negative. So we're looking at a student who just wants that attention. They'll do things to get that. I work with the teachers and the teams to make sure that they're identifying times of the day when the student is being appropriate and give them the attention then. It's also really important to make sure when we're thinking about attention that the attention is high quality or that it's meaningful. Not everyone wants a high five, but not everyone wants you to talk to them. So kind of getting that individualized focus and making sure that we're not reinforcing the problem behavior with the attention, but rather reinforcing appropriate behavior with it. And similarly, when we look at something like behavior that's maintained by escape, if you're presenting the same work to a student day in and day out, they may get sick of it, or it may be too easy or too hard. So they may engage in that problem behavior to communicate, I'm done with this, I'm all set. So we want to honor appropriate requests to say, let's take a break from this, or let's move on to something different. Also making sure that the teams are feeling comfortable enriching the curriculum, changing up materials, changing the way they're presenting lessons. Students who engage in behavior that's maintained by escape often are bored. They just don't want to do the work over and over again. And I see that most specifically in those more severe, profound settings where the students are being presented with materials that they see 5 times a day, every day. So making sure that it's enriching and that it's meaningful, but really making sure that as we look at that different function, that we're not giving that attention or giving that escape for the problem behavior, but for an appropriate behavior.
That's great. And so in thinking about how, you know, you've kind of moved from the data collection into the functional behavior assessment and then making some recommendations, perhaps in a behavior intervention plan and IEP goals, perhaps, you know, how does that work in terms of, you know, how you are working with a team and how that special educator is pivotal in that?
So some of the time it's as simple as making those recommendations like we just talked about. And other times that FBA reveals some information that we have some intensive needs to deal with. So a behavior intervention plan will be created based on that FBA. So it identifies the targeted behaviors that we want to reduce or increase. And then I work with a special educator. It's really important that in developing a behavior intervention plan, it's something that the special educator and the team feel like they can implement with fidelity. Because if they don't feel that way from the get-go, there won't be that buy-in or there may not be fidelity with the plan. So starting with preventative strategies and looking at the ways that they can set the student up for success, make the environment enriched, and then work on some responsive strategies so that we know that there is consistent responding regardless of the behavior that we see, and avoiding reinforcing negative behavior. And again, that needs to be agreed upon by the special educator and the people who will be with the student most frequently. We also look at things like specific data collection tools related to those target behaviors so that there's an evaluation process, making sure that the team and the special educator feel comfortable with crisis management techniques depending on the student. We want to make sure that regardless of what happens, the special educator feels prepared. And planning for generalization, so as the student does develop skills and we see a problem behavior reduction, that they can use it with other instructors or in different environments. But first and foremost, it's really important that within the school, anyone who's going to work with the student really feels comfortable and has the ability to engage in training, you know, with their BCBA or with their team. So I work with that special educator to make sure that they feel comfortable, have that ongoing feedback, and that everything we're doing is being implemented with fidelity to evaluate if the plan is working or not so that we can make some data-driven decisions, especially related, you know, to those IEP goals.
And so you mentioned the fidelity piece, and I think that's a really critical part of this work, you know, and in thinking about implementing a behavior intervention plan with fidelity. Can you talk just a little bit about some of the pitfalls that we could potentially get if we have a kind of a, you know, very well-informed behavior intervention plan? We've studied and collected this data. We've done this analysis through the FBA process, which could involve a school psychologist heading that work, or a BCBA, or a special educator. You know, what happens when trouble happens with the plan? You know, what are some troubleshooting things to do?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different types of problems you can run into. The one that I think about most often is maybe it's just not really working for the student. We've done a couple weeks and we make some tweaks. So you come together as a team, the special educator has some data to support that, and we look at what's not working and make sure that we can make those tweaks that are most appropriate. We also have the situations where it's not working because one person or a couple people either don't understand a component of the plan or are not implementing it appropriately. And usually what I see is something like a student has to access a special activity and they have to meet a criteria to get that. Some people don't want to push the student, they don't want to follow through, and they let it happen. So the problem we see there is that the plan may be working, but we have another variable in play. It's not being followed with fidelity. We're allowing the student to access something without having met the criteria. So that student has not understood the contingency. And what I mean to say is well, it worked with one person. Why isn't it working with another person? So it's confusing for a student, right?
Sure.
They don't understand the expectation. So those are a couple of the pitfalls. And the best way to avoid those is coming together as a team as frequently as possible. And even if it's for a brief check-in, you know, how did this week go? What worked? What didn't work? What were you struggling with? Because as the adults implementing this, we want to make sure that we can do it. So meeting with the team, whether it's the special educator or the school psychologist, come and say, you know what, this was a challenge this week. Let's address in this way. And then, you know, if there's larger changes that need to be made, coming together as a team to really evaluate that based on the data. Another huge pitfall is just trying it for a week and it doesn't work. We need to have some time to see that progress being made and for the student to be able to access those contingencies appropriately.
Right. And so it's not a quick process. It's something that develops over a period of time, I hear you saying. And
yes.
And so if you are working on an FBA with a particular student, how often would you go through that process for the benefit of those listening? You know, how often would you go through an FBA process on one particular case?
Oh, yeah. So usually there's the initial FBA, which is probably the longest part, that initial analysis and looking at the functions of the behavior. The behavior intervention plan itself is generally updated about once a year with the IEP, but what we see sometimes is that maybe that function changed. Maybe
yeah.
the student is engaging in some new behavior. So that's when the FBA would take place again. And that's to assess just the new behavior or maybe some of the changes we're seeing. And that can happen every couple of months. That can happen twice a year. It really depends on the needs of the student. But it's not typically a one and done. Some
right.
of the time we see those functions change or we see new behaviors emerge that we would like to reduce or we want to teach some new replacement skills. So it's important to make sure that's as up to date as possible.
That's great. And so what are some, just for some examples of what replacement skills are, and then we'll talk a little bit about that. And then I was hoping that to get some tips and tricks of the trade for my special educators here. And so what are some of those replacement behaviors, just giving some general examples and then some tips and tricks?
Yeah. So some of the most basic replacement behaviors, especially thinking in terms of our youngest learners, teaching functional communication is a big one. So regardless of the level of ability, if we have a student who's vocal, if we have a student using assistive technology, we want to teach functional communication. And what I mean is if they need to take a break or if they want to access something, if we can teach them a really simple way to get that, we want to honor that instead of the grabbing or the running towards it. So teaching those really basic skills of asking for things like a break, teaching the language for cookie, teaching the language for drink. We want to make sure that students have the ability to access attention, the things that they want, an appropriate way to do that, tapping on somebody's shoulder, teaching hand raising. So we may have those students who are shouting out. An appropriate replacement may be teaching how to raise hand
right.
and honoring the raising of the hand. So those are just a couple of general replacements, and they're typically very specific to the student and the setting that they're in, but making sure that it's easy to engage it and meets the same need as the problem behavior.
Exactly. So in all of your infinite wisdom, which I can't even express how much you have taught me about just the whole process of behavior and everything that we've been working on in our district with you over this past year, what are some tips and tricks for beginning special educators or those in the field who want to know more about what to do when and fill in the blank, you know, with all kinds of behaviors? You know, what are some general considerations?
Yeah, it's always important to consider in general, regardless of what kind of challenges you're seeing. Many of those challenging behaviors are shaped as a result of communication difficulties. So like I spoke about some of those replacements, we may have children who don't have a way to communicate or don't have the language yet to tell us, I want you to leave me alone or I need to go to the bathroom. We want to look at those as opportunities to help with communication first and foremost. So honoring appropriate requests, Communication is vital, and we want to make sure that we're giving the students what they want and need when they communicate it, instead of waiting until it escalates into a more challenging situation. When we do find ourselves in those situations, and I especially think of those, you know, newer special educators or changing roles, we want to make sure that we're maintaining safety and dignity for students, first and foremost, over everything else. Making sure that they have the appropriate space, that they have privacy if they need it. I think how challenging it must be for a first-time special educator to experience something like a child taking their clothes off in a classroom or crying furniture.
They didn't teach you that in, you know, grad school. What happened? Right. Yes, so, I know.
Just thinking in terms of course, keeping the child safe. We want to keep all of the other students safe, but we also don't want there to be an audience.
Right.
You know, moving other students if necessary, minimizing the number of adults who are in the room commenting, watching, making sure that keeping in mind, we're thinking about that communication, that if you can offer a choice, offer a choice.
Yeah.
There's many different ways to do things, and we can be creative and avoid power struggles, because that's not the business we're in. We want to sure that we're getting the students what they need. And then waiting is a big one. We don't have to react very quickly all of the time. And giving the students the opportunity to tell you what they want, it might take them a little longer, or respond to our requests. We can wait. That's probably the biggest tip.
Right, exactly. And that works with lots of different situations, mm-hmm. I noticed. I thank you so much, Therese, for being with us today. And I'm sure that your information and the tips that you provided will be really helpful. I know they're helpful to me. And so thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.